next to the worst way of raising a child is with a single father, but it's better than the single mother option.
Why do you think that? Why is that so?
For a number of reasons, I think. One is that first of all, fathers tend to be older. On average, they tend to have more wealth. On average, they tend to be, they're not the default position. So when you're comparing fathers, the type of father that wants to be involved is a little bit like the type of woman who wanted to become a medical doctor in the 1950s. The more barriers that you have to overcome to do something, the more it's select for people who are highly motivated. So this does not mean that the average father, the average man, makes a better father than the average mother, because you're comparing, as a rule, more motivated men to the default position as women. You're comparing men who are, as a rule, have more income, more education, and are older than the average woman is. But you also have other qualitative things that men tend to bring to child raising that seem to make a very important difference. One of those is the most important, it seems to be, is boundary enforcement. And notice I didn't say boundary setting. Both mothers and fathers tend to set boundaries about equally, probably mothers even a bit more than fathers. But fathers are much better at getting the children, at enforcing the boundaries they establish. So, for example, I'll give a couple of examples of this in real life. In real life, mom will be giving the child dinner, and will say something. Both the mother and father will give this child the same basic boundary setting. Sweetie, you can have some ice cream when you finish your peas. And so with the child, and the child will do the exact same thing with both mom and dad. They'll do something like say, "Okay, I've had some of my peas now. Can I have the ice cream?" And the difference, though, is with mom and dad will be the mom will tend to say something like, "Sweetie, I said you couldn't have your ice cream until you finish your peas, but I'll tell you what, if you have this many more peas, then you can have some ice cream or you can have the ice cream." Dad will, the child will say the same thing to dad, testing the boundaries, and dad will tend to look at the child and say something like, even sometimes non-verbally, the father's eyes will look at the child and just say, "Excuse me, you know the deal, I know the deal, you know I know the deal, and you know that I know that you know the deal." Here, if you want more, if you want ice cream, you have the option of finishing the peas. If you don't finish the peas, then no ice cream. That's it. And so if the child protests that, and so what the child has learned from the mother at this level one here, what the child's learned from the mother is, if mom says something, I shouldn't pay attention to it. I'm better off if I figure out how to negotiate a better
deal. Negotiable, yeah.
It's negotiable. If dad says something, it's not negotiable, so I might as well do it and get on with it. The result is that the child starts arguing with the mother. The mother then basically says to herself something totally different than the dad says. Inside the mother's mind's eye is this type of thing. Okay, the child is the product of a divorce. The child's been at school all day, or I haven't been with the child most of the day. These are my few precious moments with the child before the child goes to bed. Am I going to take these few precious moments and make them into a hassle, make our relationship adversarial, get into a big argument about a few peas? I don't think so. I'm going to let the child have, I'll renegotiate with the child, say for a few more peas they can have the ice cream, no big argument. The father says, if I give in here, every time I say something, the child will think it's negotiable. Everything will become an argument. There'll be a much more adversarial relationship. What I have to say will not carry authority. If I want to have the child eat a few more peas and then have the ice cream, say that up front. Give that to the child right as a given, and then go ahead but don't make it into a big argument.
So women, of course, women are softer. Women are a softer touch. They give in more easily.
Yes, and those types of things, and the people that are hurt by that are the children and the mother. And I say the mother because studies of mothers show that single moms are far more stressed than single dads are. They're more likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to go for antidepressants. They're more likely to have problems with lack of energy because everything becomes an argument with them. And the sad thing the children and the mother get into many more arguments. And then the sad thing is that while the great majority of children are raised by mothers after a divorce, at the age of 12, 13, and 14, that begins to make a big shift begins to occur. That the child oftentimes the child oftentimes falls into one of what I call the 5 D's. The child gets into discipline problems, into drugs, into drinking, into disobedience, and then at that point in time, the mother often goes, I just can't handle it. I can't take it. And then the father often takes over the raising of the child when the child is in the 13 to 15 or 16 year old age bracket, and then the mother is devastated, and the child oftentimes is doing drugs or is delinquent, and the mother is as I said devastated, and the father then takes over with much more effective boundary enforcement, and usually, not all the time, the child starts making some significant changes.
This is all, of course, in an intact family, but when you have separated parents, the children are often used as weapons, and their brain is wired differently because the discipline is divided, and often they try to gain the love of the child and to use them against the other parent. That's the most terrible thing for kids to have put upon them, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. First of all, I'm going to elaborate on what you're saying because you're hitting an extremely important point. But I just want to clarify the description that I was just giving here was more in a comparing the single mother to the single father. This is why what I was describing is one of the reasons why when single fathers raise children, they do not usually ask for child support. They do not usually get money from the government, and the children do better, and the father keeps a full-time job in addition to raising the children. So, it's really quite an amazing difference. And children that, when they're very young, people sometimes say, well, do children get, do fathers take the better children? No, it's the other way around. Children with developmental disabilities are 15 times more likely to be placed with the dad when they're young. The only time children get go with dads in significantly high percentages are when they have major developmental disability problems when they're young. So fathers get the tougher group of children as a rule and do better with them. But again, remember, we're talking about a self-selected group of fathers compared to the default mother and more educated people as a rule.
Yes, in Australia it's 7% of fathers who win custody battles and 93% of mothers. So
that is really, I know in Australia you have the equivalent of what we have here of the 14th Amendment, which is presumably says that there should be no law that discriminates based on gender, and of course that is a law that discriminates based on gender, and that really needs to be challenged in the United States at the Supreme Court level, and I believe in Australia at the highest court levels as well, because it's something that's blatantly unconstitutional, and yet it's not been challenged at that high level. But here's the more important thing, that which was what you were saying a minute ago, which is that I'd like every listener to understand that when there is a court battle, that basically the mother and the father become ineffective because both are competing to please the child. But the person that is really being undermined in court battles for custody, where both mother and father are trying to please the child, is more the role of the father. The father tends to be the better boundary enforcer. But the father becomes fearful if he's in a custody battle of enforcing boundaries because the child will just say something like, I don't like you, I hate you, I'm going to go to mom's
because mom lets me do that.
Mom lets me do that, and the child will almost always choose the parent that's most like candy. That is, the child will almost always choose the parent that's doing something that lets it control the parent. The difficulty is that that's the worst thing for the child. So it's almost like when a child is younger, whatever parent the child wants to be with when they're very young is often a good sign that that's the opposite of the parent that they should be with.
Yes.
Because it's like asking the child, you know, I remember when I was when my stepchildren were 7 and 8, when I first began to be involved with them, I said, you know, do you like being with your dad or do you like being with your mom more, and you know, and why? And they said, well, we like being with our it depends. We like being with our dad more because he takes us to more movies, and we like being with our mom more because she gives us more candy. It was like, what did that tell you about what you should pay attention to?
Of course, then dads are accused of being Disneyland dads, aren't they? They only see their children, the normal daddy's pack is every second weekend and after school holidays, and that short time, you want to give the children as much of what you would normally spread over the total time.
Yes, the Disneyland dad situation, or the child seeing the father every other weekend, is a lose-lose-lose.
Yes.
It's a lose for the child, it's a lose for the father, it's a lose for the mother. Because, you know, the mother feels resentful because, you know, oh boy, he gets to do really nice things with the kids, and because he only sees them once in a while. That's not good for the children. The children, the children need, when a child is growing up with a mother and a father, the child seems to do fairly well with more time from the mother than with the father. Because the child knows it has the underlying stability of both parents.
Yes.
And the father has a sort of a certain amount of influence, usually to bring a certain amount of discipline to the child's upbringing. But when the child is in the Disneyland dad mode, or see the father once every weekend, the father tends to do things more to please the child. But the most important thing that the child misses is that when there is a divorce, children do best when there's about an equal amount of time with the children, with both parents, because when they don't have one parent, they are not learning about that half of themselves. As a child grows up, it looks in the mirror and it sees the body language of both of its parents. It sees it has the walk of the father, the hair of the mother, the nose of the father, the eyes of the mother, and so it knows it is about both parents. So if it's primarily with one parent and it's hearing bad things, especially about the other parent, the parent it is not with that often becomes like a straw person. If there are bad things about that other parent that it's not with, if that parent is maybe a little bit alcoholic or is unreliable or is said to be a liar or doesn't seem to, then the child begins to wonder, am I a liar? Am I going to be an alcoholic? Am I going to be unreliable? Because it begins to see its genes pop out that makes it feel like whatever is being said that's bad about the other parent, that's not just criticizing the other parent, that's criticizing the half of me that is the other parent.
Well, that comes down to role modeling, doesn't it? I mean, it takes on the role of...
Yes, it's role modeling, but it's also deeper than that, because even if the father who is absent is a good father, the child doesn't know. The parent that is absent is like a straw parent, and so the child becomes, that half of the child becomes like a straw self. You don't know about that part of yourself. If you admire the father that is absent, then you feel like you can't get enough approval from somebody you overly idolize. If you feel badly about the father that's absent, you sort of feel you worry about that part of yourself being like that father. So the child seems to do best when it has a lot of contact with both parents, especially after divorce. That's what seems psychologically destabilizing. And so what you have to compare the what most judges say, which is, divorce is destabilizing. We want to have the child be in the same geographical place. If the child's been previously with the mother, keep the child with the mother. We don't want to destabilize the child. It turns out the child does not destabilize by geographically moving back and forth. It's destabilized by not psychologically knowing the parent that is absent.
Excuse me, Warren, your line is starting to break up. Maybe we'll go to a disc and I'll try and ring you up again. Maybe we'll get a clear line.
Re-establish contact.
And I will move in closer to my base.
Okay.
All right.
I'll ring you back up again, Warren.
We'll be back with
that. Sounds good.
We'll be back with Warren Farrell in a minute. Talking with Warren Farrell, author of The Myth of Male Power and Why Men Are the Way They Are. And one of the points that Warren has made is that women asking for men to protect them and therefore for the government to become the substitute husband when women don't get the protection of men is evolutionary, very natural. Men saying, "I need protection, I need help, please help me," is not so natural. These points are made in two of Warren's books, Why the Men Are the Way They Are, and also The Myth of Male Power. Now, we're just waiting to get Warren back on the line. He is in the United States of America at the moment, so Rockin' Pop's just outside working the phones frantically, and I'm sitting in here working the microphone frantically. Now, Warren has said, I did two articles that were accepted for Modern Maturity, one of the largest circulation magazines in the US. After the articles were accepted, edited, and paid for, one feminist researcher objected to them and got Modern Maturity to drop both articles. And regarding the places like the New York Times, in which I had published every single thing I'd written when I was a feminist, since I have questioned feminism, nothing I have written has been published. When I was doing the Donahue show as a feminist, I was on 7 times. I was on once when I deviated from the feminist position, and I was never invited back. So that tends to back up the idea that basically men are disadvantaged when it comes to pushing our particular point of view, and the female feminist acceptable, politically correct, I think you could say, point of view is always or generally favoured above the male point of view, which is, I think, is probably the basis of political correctness in our society, a lot of which leads on to things like advertising standards, of course, and the fact that males are being portrayed in the media as inferior and stupid, not because that's the way people see males, but because it's a default position. Because women have, it's become politically incorrect to put women down, to ridicule women, to basically rubbish their point of view, which leaves men, and we tend to find in advertising that a lot of men basically bear the brunt of this kind of situation, and we see males are being portrayed as in some ways inferior culturally and socially to women, which of course is not true. We are different. We are both equally necessary parts of the equation, and that's really all I've got to say about it. Okay, this is Smiley off his album Belt Up.
If the outside could see,
Matt Smiley off his Belt Up album, And He Loves. We're just having a bit of trouble re-establishing contact with Warren Farrell from the United States. Perhaps the satellite went down, I'm not sure. So I'll get back to the article that we were looking at before by Adam Creswell, that appeared in last week's Australian about most pregnant women drink alcohol, putting babies at risk. This is a huge issue, and this is something that people have to basically be a lot more aware of. Adam Creswell writes, even drinking as little as one drink a week may cause lesser problems, including deficient verbal and social skills, according to evidence cited in the study published in February edition of the journal Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. Lead author Lynn Colville of the Telethon Institute for Child Health Research based in Perth said, although a weakness of the study was that it asked women to recall their pre-pregnancy drinking 3 months after the birth, this meant the findings were probably an underestimate, since other studies have shown people tend to downplay their drinking as time passes. I think the main message from this is that until we know whether there's a safe level of alcohol consumption during pregnancy, the best thing is to abstain, which is what the World Health Organization recommends as well. At the time the survey was conducted, from 1995 to 1997, Australia's official guidelines recommended pregnant women refrain totally from drinking alcohol until after the baby was born. I think that's a very sensible position. Australia's alcohol guidelines for pregnant women were relaxed slightly in 2001. They now recommend pregnant women merely consider abstinence. If they do drink, the new recommendations advise women to drink less than 7 standard drinks in any 1 week, and no more than 2 drinks on any 1 day spread over 2 hours. The study showed 19% of women consumed more than 2 standard drinks at least once during the first 3 months of pregnancy. Now, we can really only speculate on the effect that this is having on the population of young Australians growing up at the moment, who really do have a lot on their plate to deal with. You know, we've got the environment, the way it's all collapsing around us. We've got toxins in the water. We've got toxins in the air. We've also got an outcome-based education system, which a lot of people would argue is not the best way to do things. All right, Rock and Pop Van is back in the studio, and I do believe we have Warren Farrell back on the line.
Hello. This is not Warren Farrell. I deny it.
No, we're not blaming you, but we've had all sorts of technical difficulties.
I was not at all thinking that you were blaming me.
Oh, what a shame. We'll have to do this again anyway. We've still got 6 or 7 minutes left.
Yes, okay. It is a shame. I was sitting here saying, I'm wondering what's happening here. My assistant said, I'm sure they were just politely getting rid of you.
Not at all.
No, we were desperate. Trying to fill in the time that you were offline. There's so many questions that we had here ready for you. I'm just wondering, perhaps to sum up in some way, and we'll have to get you back on again if you would be kind enough to in the future.
I'd be happy to.
And make it a full hour the next time with a good phone line. Is the feminist movement now more focused on dominance rather than equality, perhaps?
I'm afraid the feminist movement did some wonderful things and some terrible things. The wonderful things that it did is that it really helped open up options for women. The terrible thing that it did is that it, in the process, it demonized men, and it made it seem, and you know, what we should have had was, we should have all understood, and this is not really a feminist's fault alone, because, you know, feminists spoke up and basically, you know, we often say that there's a battle of a war between the sexes, or battle of the sexes, and in fact there really has not been a battle of the sexes in the last 35 years. It's been a war in which only one side has shown up, and men have basically put their heads in the sand and hoped the bullets would miss. And so we've tended to attend more, you know, rugby games and football games and soccer games than we do, protests for saying this, you know, this we have rights too when the children.
We don't fight women. We open doors for them. We pay for their drinks. We don't tend to fight women.
We're really afraid of women in many respects.
Yes.
We're afraid that if we don't, if we ask a beautiful woman out for dinner, and especially if it's the first date and we're the most insecure, we're afraid not to pay the check. We're afraid to say, let's see, does equality apply to our everyday life here? And so we're afraid that we'll be rejected. And as long as men are so sexually and emotionally dependent upon women, we will basically give women the same type of cues that we blame, that I was saying that women often do with children. Women don't set demand enough of children oftentimes, and then the children become spoiled and self-centered and narcissistic, and then we tend to do the same with women. We don't speak up and say we have our perspective also. I'm happy to listen to yours. I want to listen to yours, but I also will not continue a relationship where you don't also listen to mine. And so we really That process starts from parenting, where we encourage, we say to most children that sex is bad, and then we ask boys to initiate what's bad, and so boys feel shamed and dirty about what they're interested in, as opposed to saying sex is joyful, it's wonderful, aren't men fantastic that they risk the rejection? And by the way, daughter, you should be taking responsibility for risking rejection also, and don't expect a man to risk rejection to ask you out and then pay for more rejection once he asks you out. And so everything needs to be redone right from the very beginning, and we're all yes. part of a deep process that is mistraining both women and men, and that's what needs to be changed.
Now this has been happening for the last 30 years, isn't it? The changes. Where do you think we are today in historic time frame? Do you think there's any improvement and a better understanding about the issues today as compared to say 30 years ago in the general community?
Well, I think the best summary is what I mentioned a minute ago, is that basically women's issues are much better understood. Every aspect of a woman's life has been well articulated for the past 35 years or so. But when women have said, men don't do the housework, men batter women more than women batter men, men are basically deadbeat dads, men have not responded very effectively. We haven't been heard. We haven't built the political base that would allow the media to hear us. We haven't had women's studies. We've had women's studies courses, but not men's studies courses. So in the United States, 150,000 women each year graduate from women's studies courses, and they go into the media. They go into human resources. They go into every portion of life in which decisions about gender are made, and because they believe that men have controlled the system, and they do that at the benefit of men and at the expense of women, and men have not spoken up and said, no, it's not true that men earn more money than women for the same work. What is true is that men earn more money than women for 25 different things that we do differently, that are sacrifices, that if anybody does those things, they will earn as much money. And so we haven't shared our perspective on that, and therefore we've allowed women to continue with a jaundiced and an increasingly negative view of men that has translated into a negative view of fathers that has made judges fearful of saying men and women both, judges fear that if the woman says, oh, I'm afraid of my husband in some way, the judge is then afraid to give the child equally to the father because he doesn't want to do anything that could increase a woman's fear.
So we've got a long way to go.
We have a very long way to go. And in many respects, we have a longer way to go. Men have a longer way to go than we did before the feminist movement because we have 35 years of demonization to overcome.
Yes.
We are now the sex that anybody can laugh at, mock, put down, put in jail more quickly. If we die or we're killed, we're not valued as much. And so we have a huge, men's issues are just plain not understood, and that's not good for our sons because we all want our sons to have as fair a shake in as they grow up as our daughters do.
Yes.
And I say that as a father of, you know, of two daughters.
Yes, I've got five daughters and nine grandchildren, and I worry about what lies ahead.
For them. Absolutely, and we really need to worry about what lies ahead. It's, you know, if we don't, we'll you know, already in the United States, and I believe in Australia, the suicide rates for males are way exceeding females, and when males are 85 years of age or older, it's 1,350% greater for males than it is for females. Already for our sons, we're not going to college at nearly the same rate as our daughters are.
And same so over here. 56% to 44% over here.
Yes, it's exactly. It's an industrialized nation's problem.
Can I just cut in and ask a question regarding the American situation, how you feel about the idea of Hillary Clinton becoming the next president of your fine country?
Well, she's a very experienced, very bright, very intelligent woman, but she is also very feminist and really does buy the belief that that men have had the power, and women need to sort of catch up, and that therefore affirmative action and other types of benefits to women shouldn't really be questioned; they should be applauded, and that's considered progressive. Liberals, of which I basically am one, do in the United States are arrogant enough to call themselves progressives, and progressive is an arrogant word for anybody to call yourself, because it means that the people that disagree with you are regressive. And the problem with calling yourself progressive is you close your ears when you call yourself progressive to other people's points of view. And that's been, you know, as feminism has become the one-party system of gender politics, it has become as arrogant as all one-party systems become. When you give anybody too much power, they corrupt. And that's just basically a rule of all human beings.
Warren, she was quoted in yesterday's paper, when you're attacked, you have to deck your opponents. So she's going to deck a few people around in your area, and we'll have to start decking back, I guess.
We're going to have to actually start closing this down, I'm afraid. We've actually run out of time.
We've gone over time, Warren, so it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show, and we hope that you will come back in the near future. And
we can continue this discussion.
I really would be delighted to. It's just a pleasure talking with both of you, and I look forward to making a part two happen soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Warren. And that concludes the show for today. Next week we have the ex-wife of the author Bill Stone King, who we had on a few weeks ago, and she will reply to his some of the quotes that he made in his book. And so thank you for listening this week, and we look forward to the company next week. We're dads on the air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all